disrupt its operations. The successful assembly of a plane now depends not just on a few factories remaining intact, but on safe passage across oceans, acceptable labor conditions in Japan, a lack of natural disasters in Sweden, stable exchange rates, and flexible supply chain management. In Iraq, we encountered unprecedented levels of disruption. An operation on one side of the country would spontaneously incite reactions from a cell on the other that we did not even know existed. One misstep of ours or one piece of effective AQI propaganda could make the social media rounds and spark riots within hours. One video of a militant attack would have an immediate effect on insurgent recruitment numbers and sectarian reprisals. And all of these events happened almost every day. In fact, the developments of recent years have led to a completely different and less predictable world. Because of speed and interdependence, street vendor Tariq Altayeb Mohammed Bouazizi could set off a chain of events that toppled multiple governments faster than the rest of the world could even process the news. Of course, there were successful revolutionaries and butterfly effect phenomena before the information age, but new technologies have created an unprecedented proliferation of opportunities for small, historically disenfranchised actors to have a butterfly effect. Some of this has positive consequences, like entrepreneurial success. Other manifestations are devastating. Terrorists, insurgents, and cybercriminals have taken advantage of speed and interdependence to cause death and wreak havoc. But it all exhibits the unpredictability that is a hallmark of complexity. Today we all find ourselves surrounded by hurricanes. In the task force, we saw this in the effects of snowballing insurgencies. But these changes have left their mark not only on the battlefield, but almost everywhere. When hackers infiltrated the Associated Press's Twitter account in 2013 and sent out a message claiming the White House had been hit by two explosions and President Obama was injured, the Dow Jones fell 143 points in a brief but widespread market panic. The tweet was deleted as soon as it appeared, but its momentary presence was enough to trigger both impulsive human behavior and the high-frequency trading algorithms now used throughout the markets, which read the news and perform trades in response in mere nanoseconds. One trader saw the Associated Press-induced flash crash as a comment on how vulnerable the markets are to random pieces of information. A more lighthearted example. When musician Dave Carroll's guitar was broken by United Airlines baggage handlers, he spent 9 months navigating the company's telephone directory maze of customer service representatives to no avail. So he wrote a song called United Breaks Guitars and posted the video on YouTube. Within one day, the video had racked up 150,000 hits and Carroll received a phone call from an abashed director of customer solutions at United. Within 3 days, the video had more than a million hits and United's stock price fell 10%, costing shareholders $180 million in value. 600,000 times the value of the guitar. Within a week, the song peaked as the number one download on iTunes, and the company made a public show of donating $3,000, the cost of a new guitar, to the Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz at Carroll's request. The makers of his broken instrument, Taylor Guitars, sent him two for free after watching his video. All of this creates challenges for systems built for a simpler era. The global aid system, for instance, which once depended on connecting individual donor governments to individual recipient governments, has in recent decades transitioned from few to few to a many-to-many market, in which thousands of NGOs try to link up with millions of recipients. The system now includes some 15,000 donor missions in 54 recipient countries every year. The result is that health workers in some sub-Saharan African states spend so much time meeting Western delegates that they can only do their real jobs in the evening. The world of many-to-many has produced tremendous gains in some sectors, but these gains have come at a high cost in others, specifically those that require coordination at scale. Challenges like those faced by aid agencies and the myriad other organizations caught in what author and development consultant Ben Ramalingham dubs the emergent wayward swirl generated by social media create questions about how we confront domains that were once predictable but are no longer. Practitioners wrestling with these questions use slightly different terminology from the optimistic interconnected. They use phrases like discontinuity, disruption, or the recently minted military acronym VUCA. Volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. They know that the world in which Emmylou will grow up is not just marginally different from that of previous generations. It is vastly faster and more interdependent, and thus essentially complex in entirely new ways. She lives in the wayward swirl, a totally different place from the clockwork universe. We get in trouble when we try to use tools designed for the latter to tinker with the former. Square peg, round hole. Many great thinkers, most notably the 19th century polymath Henri Poincaré, have observed aspects of the phenomenon that we now call complexity, but the concept's coming out party was thrown in a 1948 paper in American Science. Science and Complexity by Warren Weaver, clocked in at a mere 8 pages and involved no original research. It was an essay on the nature and aims of scientific thought, but it has left an enduring mark. Weaver argued that science up through the 1800s had concerned itself with questions of organized simplicity, problems involving one or two variables, like the attraction between two magnets or the rotation of the Earth around the sun. Weaver also noted that the first half of the 20th century had concerned itself predominantly with questions of disorganized complexity, problems like the behavior of a gas, where the sample size of molecules is so high that one can approximate it with averages. This, too, is a much simpler challenge than that of organized complexity, but it is less relevant to our argument. But, Weaver observed, this was not the way much of the real world worked. Living organisms, for instance, are more likely to present situations in which a half dozen or even several dozen quantities are all varying simultaneously and in subtly interconnected ways. Such traits, he noted, are found in ecosystems, economies, and political systems. In other words, the real world is full of the knotted interdependencies of complexity, and science was not equipped to deal with this. Indeed, science actively avoided these unpleasant truths, preferring to simplify things to fit the clockwork universe. Such efforts, Weaver maintained, are futile. You cannot force a square peg into a round hole, and you cannot force the complex to conform to rules meant for the merely complicated. A pool table of 16 balls, he argued, presents a fundamentally different type of problem from a pool table with only 2 or 3 balls, just as cold fronts are fundamentally different from comets. The table with 16 balls confounds prediction. On what does the price of wheat depend? Is far more complex still. Problems of organized complexity involve a sizable number of factors which are interrelated into an organic whole. These problems are just too complex, he wrote, to yield to the old 19th century techniques which were so dramatically successful on 2, 3, or 4 variable problems of simplicity. Weaver actually used the word complicated, which he employed interchangeably with complex throughout his work, distinguishing them from things that are simple. At the time of his writing, the terminology in the field was far less crisp than it has become since his paper kicked off the discipline, but the ideas he was trying to get across are better captured by what we today refer to with the word complex. Once scientists, historians, and journalists began looking, evidence in support of Weaver's observation was everywhere. Perhaps most visibly in the history of human tinkering with nature's complex ecosystems. The attempt to fix the grayback beetle problem in Queensland, Australia, is a famous case in point. When an infestation of beetle grubs decimated sugarcane fields in the 1930s, agronomists were delighted to learn of the Rhinella marina, or cane toad, whose appetite for grayback beetles had successfully kept the pest in check in Hawaii. The Australian government imported 102 of these miracle critters in June 1935 and released them into the Little Mulgrave River. Today, if you scoop a net through the waters of the Little Mulgrave River or those of any nearby river, lake, pond, or estuary, it will come up full of what looks like mud, but is actually a mass of glossy black cane-toed tadpoles. Given an abundance of quiet ponds and the absence of Hawaiian predators, an unexpectedly large proportion of the 40,000 eggs that a female toad can lay in one summer survive to adulthood in Australia. The agronomist's projections for toad survival were based on a smaller figure. This was the equivalent of incorrectly estimating the base number in the exponential function of population growth, the kind of incremental difference that would not have been a problem for predicting the return of Halley's Comet, but would turn out to be a big, big problem for Australian wildlife. The toads multiplied and multiplied. They spread to parks, gardens, freeways, and ponds. They ate fish, frogs, small birds, and crabs, as well as rare species like the pygmy marsupial mouse. One researcher found that cane toads would attack and eat ping-pong balls. The only things they do not eat, apparently, are Australian grayback beetles. Differences in the life cycles of the Australian and Hawaiian species mean that the beetles and toads were never in the fields at the same time. Furthermore, the toads can kill not only by eating other animals, but also by being eaten. Their poisonous skins meant that dogs, ducks, and snakes died in droves after biting into them. Fences, traps, and other barriers have fallen like miniature Maginot lines to the toads' amphibious assault. The species now covers 40% of Queensland and has moved into other states. An American ecologist summed it up as classic human disaster. An ecosystem is at threat by being chopped away at the base, and that will have repercussions all the way up through the food chain in which the toad has insinuated itself. The list of catastrophic attempts at ecological interventions stretches from the cane toad to the kudzu vine that has spread over some 7 million acres of American land, to the million-strong flocks of starlings that blacken American skies. A Shakespeare enthusiast who wanted to bring every species mentioned by the playwright to the New World introduced 60 starlings into New York's Central Park in 1890. They have since spread geographically and now roost in flocks that can devour 20 tons of potatoes per day. As with butterflies and weather, the lesson here is not that all introduced species will spread like crazy. Any of these fauna might just as easily have died out within a few weeks. If only some slight properties of the environment had interacted differently, or if the base number had been marginally different. Complex systems are fickle and volatile, presenting a broad range of possible outcomes. The type and sheer number of interactions prevent us from making accurate predictions. As a result, treating an ecosystem as though it were a machine with predictable trajectories from input to output is a dangerous folly. Likewise, economic systems, the products of complex knots of human factors, confound linear attempts at prediction and control. It is because of this complexity that economist and philosopher Friedrich Hayek argued against state-run economic planning. In his landmark essay, The Theory of Complex Phenomena, he drew a distinction between the degree of complexity characteristic of a particular kind of phenomenon and the degree of complexity to which, by a combination of elements, any kind of phenomena can be built up. In other words, some systems are essentially complex, like the human brain or society, whereas other systems, like a big machine or a factory, might appear complex because they have a lot of moving parts, but are essentially complicated. He argued that national economies, unlike industrial production, could never be transformed into mechanical systems with reductionist solutions. Their behavior results from the decision-making of millions of people, and all these decisions influence one another, making it impossible to forecast how markets will move. As in a game of chess, there are just too many possibilities for a prescriptive instruction card. Butterfly effects in the economy, triggered by tiny initial disturbances, are common. This complexity has only grown denser as economies have globalized. The hacker attack on AP demonstrates that these nonlinear disturbances are becoming more likely. In the words of British sociologist John Urey, when China gets a cold, the U.S. sneezes. To extend the Lorenz butterfly metaphor, we seem, increasingly, to live in a world of hurricanes. This sneezes quote has a complicated history. The original statement, of which there are now many popular variations, is thought to have originated with Austria's Prince Clemens von Metternich. When France sneezes, Europe catches a cold. Metternich was referencing the spread of popular revolutions across Europe in the 19th century, and surely never imagined that his quote would be modified to apply to the economies of China and the United States. A predictive hubris, perhaps bred by centuries of success at applying Newtonian models to complicated problems, has fooled us into believing that with enough data and hard work, the complex riddles of economies can be decoded. But as Weaver pointed out, you cannot force the square peg of complexity into the round hole of the complicated. The average forecasting error in the U.S. analyst community between 2001 and 2006 was 47% over 12 months and 93% over 24 months. As writer and investor James Montier puts it, the evidence on the folly of forecasting is overwhelming. Frankly, the three blind mice have more credibility than any macro forecaster at seeing what is coming. In November 2007, economists in the survey of professional forecasters examining some 45,000 economic data series foresaw less than a 1 in 500 chance of an economic meltdown as severe as the one that would begin 1 month later. Debates still rage about whether we understand economics well enough to exert even slight interventions like adjusting discount rates. But the graveyard of centrally planned economies such as the Soviet Union's, much like the necropolis of planned interventions in ecosystems, would seem to validate the idea that some things cannot be fitted into a reductionist straitjacket. Attempts to control complex systems by using the kind of mechanical, reductionist thinking championed by thinkers from Newton to Taylor, breaking everything down into component parts or optimizing individual elements, tend to be pointless at best or destructive at worst. Back to management. Frederick Taylor's managerial solutions were unequivocally designed for complicated problems rather than complex ones. The Midvale Steelworks factory floor may have been a cacophonous circus of whirling gears and white-hot iron, but the machines worked in straightforward ways, and the management structures Taylor created functioned like organizational analogs of those mechanical devices. Tasks moved from one worker to another, from one corner of the factory to another. Change was linear. Problems with one machine could not organically spread to others. Inversely, a single innovation could not go viral and turn factory owners into billionaires overnight. Companies would steadily ratchet their way toward success or failure over the course of years. The predictability of this environment enabled Taylor to break complicated processes down into independent, repeatable actions and, at a larger scale, to divide whole organizations into independent departments. Because he could anticipate that tomorrow would bring the same 8 varieties of pulp as today, he could reduce the chemistry of papermaking to a simple chart. Because he knew that the same machines would be in place with the same flow of water, he could give workers precise instruction cards for their actions. The industrial world, where almost everything could be measured and mechanized, where individual variables could be isolated, tested, and optimized, lent itself to this model. As complicated as it was, it almost all lay under the manager's capacity for calculation, prediction, and control. Planned efficiency became the lifeblood of good management. Everything else, from physical design to organizational structure to leadership behavior, was a natural extension of this goal. As we have crept toward the many-to-many environment of complexity, we have engineered increasingly complicated solutions. Gifted managers have developed intricate protocols and organizational hierarchies to cover all likelihoods. The baseline belief that any problem can be known in its entirety has never faded. Anyone who has worked in business or government for a few decades can testify to the seemingly endless increases in rules and paperwork. Nowhere was this more visible than at the Pentagon, where the growth of the Department of Defense manifested itself in an ever-expanding set of codes and procedures. In Iraq, we were using complicated solutions to attack a complex problem. For decades, we had been able to execute our linear approach faster than the external environment could change, and as a result, we believed we were doing something different from other organizations. In fact, we were as bureaucratic as anyone else. We were just more efficient in our execution. Efficiency was the defining excellence of our awesome machine, and it had enabled our assembly line of counterterrorism to keep humming along. But by 2004, the world had outpaced us. In the time it took us to move a plan from creation to approval, the battlefield for which the plan had been devised would have changed. By the time it could be implemented, the plan, however ingenious in its initial design, was often irrelevant. We could not predict where the enemy would strike, and we could not respond fast enough when they did. It is hard, if not impossible, to draw a firm line separating the complicated from the complex. The different domains that deal with complexity use various taxonomies for differentiation. Some taxonomies of complex include systems that automatically adjust in response to disruption, resilient systems, which we will address later. For our purposes, the ability to predict is the most relevant criterion. And determining exactly when things become unpredictable is tricky. All the phenomena we have discussed are at some levels predictable. We can predict the rainfall in a particular city tomorrow with relative accuracy, just not in 6 months. We can reliably anticipate that inflation will cause shopkeepers to raise their prices this month, but not whether it might trigger a recession in a year. It is helpful to frame things in terms of time scale. For our purposes, we can think of a phenomenon as exhibiting complexity over a given time frame. if there are so many interactions that one cannot reasonably forecast the outputs based on the inputs. By this definition, weather would be complex over the time span of a day, but not a month. This is why it is relevant not only that things have become more interconnected, but also that processes have become faster. These two variables combined mean that the amount of interactive complexity previously contained in many months of, say, local conversation and letter exchange might now be squeezed into a few hours of explosive social media escalation. Knowing the outcome of a war at its start has always been impossible, otherwise we would not have to fight them, and no one working at Ford in 1915 could foresee what automobiles and production processes would look like in 1950. But on more immediate time horizons, for much of the past century, things remained manageable. An enemy's troops could move only so far overnight. A competing automobile could be brought to market only so fast. Military thinking has always had to accommodate unpredictability or friction, the divergence of reality from plan, but strategists could reliably predict events further out than we can now. In Iraq, every day brought with it the unpredictability of an entire war. Suicide bombings seemed tactically capricious, and any person with access to the internet, cleaning products, and ball bearings could become a threat overnight. Monitoring and developing contingency plans to deal with 15 enemy submarines is one thing. Doing the same for a population of 30 million people is practically impossible, not to mention potentially unethical. As with Lorenz's butterflies, it was impossible to tell which events would lead to what kinds of results. This is the new world we all share. There are too many events occurring simultaneously for any entity, even one equipped with the surveillance capabilities of our task force, to monitor. And with the ability of individuals and small groups to communicate with millions of people, there is no way to be sure which of those events will transform into a threat. Events like the YouTube spread of Tariq Al-Tayyib Mohamed Bouazizi's protest, the hacker attack on AP and Dave Carroll's explosively popular ballad, along with the whole family of viral disruptions that characterize contemporary life, were unthinkable 30 years ago. Even the word viral hints at the fact that today's environment resembles an organism or an ecosystem, the kind of interconnected system whose crisscrossing pathways allow phenomena to spread. This is a very different environment from the linear, one-to-the-next connectedness of items on Taylor's merely complicated factory floor. The amount of non-linear change that once took months to play out can now happen in the time that it takes to type 140 characters. Big data will not save us. In Iraq, cutting-edge technology had provided us with the holy grail of military operations, near-perfect situational awareness, or COP, Common Operational Picture. This was the first war in which we could see all of our operations unfolding in real time. Video feeds from unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs or drones, gave us live footage of missions, while microphones carried by our operators provided audio. We enjoyed access to data on population, economic activity, oil exports, generation of electricity, and attitudes through polling. We were connected to our partner organizations in real time. A technology called Blue Force Tracker tagged all of our vehicles with GPS monitoring, so our maps always showed the exact positioning of our forces. While this profusion of information proved of great value, it was never very useful for prediction. In a simpler world, our leaps in data would have been of great predictive value, but the reality of increased complexity meant that when it came to foresight, we were essentially chasing our own tail, and it was getting away from us. Meteorologists looking to predict the weather might think that forecasts might be perfected if they could just get enough information about butterfly wings. Science historian James Glick explains the folly in pursuing this. Even if we covered the earth in a lattice of sensors spaced 1 foot apart, and even if every one of these sensors provided flawless readings, we would still not know whether it would rain in a month, because the small spaces between those sensors hide tiny deviations that can be of massive consequence. Our Herculean effort would produce at best a marginally improved predictive capacity. Just as the task force's real-time information was a powerful tool, but did not enable us to predict terrorist attacks. We hear a great deal about the wonders of big data, which certainly has advanced our understanding of the world in dramatic ways. Retailers can track who bought what and where they bought it. Sociologists can sift through vast amounts of political, economic, and societal information searching for patterns. There is tremendous potential for this technology, but as with Blue Force Tracker and the other tools at our disposal in Iraq, it is unlikely that it will enable effective long-term prediction of the type that we crave. Data-rich records can be wonderful for explaining how complex phenomena happened and how they might happen. But they can't tell us when and where they will happen. For instance, data on the spread of a virus can provide an insight into how contagion patterns look in our networked world, but that is very different from knowing exactly where the next outbreak will occur, who precisely will end up getting sick, and where they will go next. Gaining understanding is not always the same as predicting. Data can determine average outcomes with great accuracy. How much time a person in a given age demographic is likely to spend on Facebook every day, or even, based on an individual's habits, what she is most likely to do on a given day. A friend who works at a company that uses big data to generate these sorts of insights once joked that he could tell me what I was going to eat for lunch. But of course, he couldn't. He could only tell me what I was likely to eat for lunch. And a hallmark of complexity is that small, occasional deviations can have massive impact. Data might have enabled the Tunisian authorities to determine what Bouazizi was most likely to do on the day he self-immolated, but that would have done nothing to foresee what he actually did, or the calamity that ensued. If you're trying to track 100, 1,000, or 10,000 Bouazizis, it's inevitable that at least a few of those will depart from expectation, rendering plans based on expected outcomes useless. And thanks to the wayward swirl of an interconnected, complex, nonlinear environment, when Bouazizi diverged from expectation, the impact was exponential. Big data will not save us because the same technological advances that brought us these mountains of information and the digital resources for analyzing them have at the same time created volatile communication webs and media platforms, taking aspects of society that once resembled comets and turning them into cold fronts. We have moved from data-poor but fairly predictable settings to data-rich, uncertain ones. Like most organizations, our task force understood very little of this in 2004, so we kept trying to predict and plan better because that is what we had learned good management to be. Civilian organizations are encountering the same problem. Management practices are unable to help companies cope with volatility. This is evidenced by the increasingly shorter lifespan of firms. 50 years ago, a Fortune 500 firm was expected to last around 75 years. Today, this life expectancy is less than 15 years and is constantly declining. The Fortune 500 list of 2011 featured only 67 companies that appeared on the list of 1955, meaning that just 13.4% of the Fortune 500 firms in 1955 were still on the list 56 years later. 87% of the companies simply couldn't keep up. They had either gone bankrupt, merged with other companies, been forced to go private, or fallen off the list completely. The churn has been so incredible that the companies on the list in 1955 would be unrecognizable to readers today. As corporate strategist and Professor Robert Grant puts it, in the last quarter of the 20th century, macroeconomic disequilibrium, exchange rate volatility, the microelectronics revolution, and the emergence of newly industrializing countries marked the end of post-war economic stability. Since economic and market forecasts provided the foundation for strategic planning, inability to predict demand, prices, exchange rates, and interest rates represented a fundamental challenge to companies' ability to plan. Similarly, management thinker Gary Hamel writes that companies now find themselves in ecosystems and value webs over which they exert almost no control, giving them little ability to predict or plan their own destinies. In such settings, the ritual of strategic planning, which assumes the future will be more or less like the present, is more hindrance than help. This was exactly what we were finding with the institutional strictures, planning routines, and an organizational structure and culture firmly embedded in the notion of predictive mastery that governed the task force. Our complicated solutions were flailing in a newly complex environment. The inevitable outcome of this approach is perhaps best summarized by Henry Mintzberg, author of The Rise and Fall of Strategic Planning. Setting oneself on a predetermined course in unknown waters is the perfect way to sail straight into an iceberg.
Recap. The technological changes of recent decades have led to a more interdependent and fast-paced world. This creates a state of complexity. Complexity produces a fundamentally different situation from the complicated challenges of the past. Complicated problems required great effort, but ultimately yielded to prediction. Complexity means that in spite of our increased abilities to track and measure, the world has become, in many ways, vastly less predictable. This unpredictability is fundamentally incompatible with reductionist managerial models based around planning and prediction. The new environment demands a new approach.
Chapter 4. Doing the Right Thing. That AQI was successful was obvious. They steered clear of most icebergs and, more remarkably, even when they hit one, they did not sink. They patched the hole and built a better boat. It was this capability that most frustrated and intrigued us. How they were so successful was less clear. AQI's network was organic and associative, held together by a property we could not identify. The messy networks drawn on our whiteboards showed no proper structure, and without a structure, logic held that the organization should have collapsed on its own. But it did not. They were decentralized, but they were also coherent. The scope of attacks like the September 30th sewage plant bombing demanded well-coordinated directives, tight accounting, and widespread information exchange of a kind we were used to seeing only in the most disciplined military units. Their deadly missions far exceeded what could be achieved by distributing a handbook and some internet propaganda to an informal smattering of acolytes. Even as AQI metastasized across Iraq, growing in scale and reach, they somehow preserved their agility. In the first phase of our fight, our task force had focused on hunting down former associates of Saddam Hussein. Most of this activity was concentrated on the area between Baghdad and Tikrit, where Saddam's officials and high-ranking officers had estates along the fertile banks of the Tigris. It was at one of these farms on the outskirts of Tikrit that we captured Saddam in December 2003. Using our best night raid procedures, our carefully honed one best way for bagging bad guys, we made relatively short work of Saddam's apparatchiks. We used our fast roping skills. We offset our assaults from the actual targets and foot-marched in to maximize surprise. We deployed close-quarters battle tactics when we entered houses, clearing them room by room and floor by floor. When the war shifted from defeating Saddam to countering the AQI-led insurgency, we applied these same tactics. But it was much harder. Although AQI's center of gravity lay far from the posh precincts where we found Saddam's people, they had been watching. They knew that we preferred to operate at night because of our night vision advantage, so they departed their safe houses at dusk, dispersing and sleeping in the surrounding fields. They saw how we assaulted and cleared houses, so they began placing machine guns in pillboxes at the tops of staircases, lying in wait. They knew we sought to capture their leaders to gain intelligence, so many of them took to sleeping in suicide vests. It did not matter if they lost firefights, botched procedures, and fielded less capable fighters. It did not matter that there was no single process that they could execute anywhere near as well as we could. AQI could adjust and survive. We were stronger, more efficient, more robust, but AQI was agile and resilient. In complex environments, resilience often spells success, while even the most brilliantly engineered fixed solutions are often insufficient or counterproductive. Scientist Brian Walker and writer David Salt, in their book on the subject, describe resilience as the capacity of a system to absorb disturbance and still retain its basic function and structure. In a complex world, disturbances are inevitable, making such a capacity to absorb shocks increasingly important. As a result, resilience is increasingly being studied across a wide variety of disciplines, from psychology to hydrology. Few examples of the concept are more dramatic than the shifting Dutch approach to water. The threat from behind. On the last day of January 1953, a windstorm on the North Sea and a full moon joined forces to create a massive storm tide that swamped low-lying areas in the east of England and Scotland. On the other side of the North Sea, in the southwest corner of the Netherlands, where the Rhine River fractures into a tangle of estuaries and low-lying islands, the tide swept over the dikes and poured into the aptly named province of Zeeland, Sealand. It swallowed up homes, schools, and hospitals, claiming more than 1,800 lives. For this small, developed, prosperous, and water-savvy country, it was a shocking calamity. Water has shaped everything about the Netherlands, from the postcard-pretty canals of Amsterdam to the country's famously consensus-driven politics, a legacy of the cooperation required to drain large tracts of land. Legislating where water goes is an almost instinctive Dutch impulse, and it had stood them well in the past. In the wake of the tragedy, the government responded with a never-again urgency. The Dutch had been building walls against the sea for a millennium, but now they would build a wall mightier, stronger, and longer than any the world had ever seen. The Delta Works, completed in 1997, was a massive 40-year-long construction project that links dams, storm surge barriers, and sluices, and effectively shortens the coastline in need of protection by dikes. The American Society of Civil Engineers considered the Delta Works one of the seven wonders of the modern world. Had the system been in place in 1953, it would have protected Zeeland from the North Sea flood. However, as with the Maginot Line, a robust protection against a known threat is not always sufficient. In complex systems, threats can flow from many places. In 1993 and 1995, snowmelt in the Swiss Alps met with heavy rainfall downstream, and the Rhine swelled, surging from Switzerland through Germany to the Netherlands. Like the German tanks that had traversed some of the same territory a half century earlier, the waters ignored the ingeniously built defense now facing the wrong way. This time the flood came from behind. Though it was not nearly as catastrophic as the 1953 event, Zeeland flooded. 250,000 people were evacuated, and hundreds of millions of dollars in damage occurred. As with the cane toad's toxic spread across Australia, the problem was partly of human creation. People have been improving the workings of rivers for thousands of years, straightening their wayward courses and fencing them in with dikes to protect the surrounding land against foreseeable calamities. Such predictive design is fine in complicated environments, but often dangerous in complex ones. While a command-and-control approach of high levees and flood walls decreased the risk of small floods, it actually increased the risks of larger, more devastating floods, because it narrowed the channels of rivers, forcing the water to rise higher and flow faster. At the same time, due to subsidence, the land behind the dikes sank lower, and increasing numbers of people moved into areas that had been floodplains, losing their sense of the natural dynamics of rivers. The Dutch Department of Water Management estimates a river flood in Zeeland today could now put 4 million people at risk. The drive to optimize created a new type of threat. This time, however, the Dutch are taking a different approach. Room for the River, the new water management plan for the region, reverses centuries of command and control responses to nature. It includes measures such as creating new bypasses and lowering dikes so that farmland along the rivers can serve as floodplains for the inevitable overflow of the rivers. These measures will reduce high water levels in the Rhine, Meuse, and Waal rivers and increase their resilience to flooding. It is, in the words of one journalist, a radical, even heretical notion in a land where dikes have been piled ever higher for more than a millennium. But as an expert at a major storm surge facility explained, if you fight nature, nature is going to strike back. Water needs space. Room for the River accepts the reality that floods are inevitable, representing a shift in mentality from making the Netherlands flood-proof to making it flood-resilient. In the Netherlands, people are coming to understand that the early command and control approach was not working. Other countries and organizations are now following suit, stepping away from predictability and focusing on increasing resilience instead. Resilience thinking is a burgeoning field that attempts to deal in new ways with the new challenges of complexity. In a resilience paradigm, managers accept the reality that they will inevitably confront unpredicted threats. Rather than erecting strong, specialized defenses, they create systems that aim to roll with the punches or even benefit from them. Resilient systems are those that can encounter unforeseen threats and, when necessary, put themselves back together again. Investor and writer Nassim Taleb captures a similar concept with the term anti-fragile systems. Fragile systems, he argues, are those that are damaged by shocks. Robust systems weather shocks. And anti-fragile systems, like immune systems, can benefit from shocks. Though the concept's popularity has increased in recent years, many resilience techniques are not new. In environmental infrastructure, they often mark a return to the kind of cautious coexistence with nature that defined much of human history. Resilience thinkers argue that we have inadvertently fragilized many of the systems that surround us. Our urge to specialize, reap efficiencies, and impose our demands for unnatural predictability has, like the rerouting of the Rhine, created new threats and damaged our ability to bounce back. As environmentalists David Salt and Brian Walker explain in their book, Resilience Thinking, humans are great optimizers. We look at everything around us, whether a cow, a house, or a share portfolio, and ask ourselves how we can manage it to get the best return. Our modus operandi is to break the things we're managing down into its component parts and understand how each part functions and what inputs will yield the greatest outputs. But the more you optimize elements of a complex system of humans and nature for some specific goal, the more you diminish that system's resilience. A drive for efficient, optimal state outcome has the effect of making the total system more vulnerable to shocks and disturbances. Resilience thinking is the inverse of predictive hubris. It is based in a humble willingness to know that we don't know, and expect the unexpected. Old tropes that often receive lip service but are usually disregarded in favor of optimization. Most of the time, our instinct is to protect ourselves through prediction and by massing strength against the predicted threat. John Doyle, a professor of engineering at Caltech, describes these types of systems as robust yet fragile. Man-made engineering feats like the Delta Works that are brilliantly designed, ambitious in scale, but ultimately simpler, more mechanistic, and more rigid than the environment they attempt to regulate. Their robust responses to a single threat make them brittle and unresilient. Andrew Zolli, a resilience thinker and writer, uses the Egyptian pyramids as an example of robustness. The fact that they are still standing proves the pyramids are extremely robust. They have successfully resisted all the stressors the architects had in mind when building them. Wind, rain, and the other anticipated degradations of time. But if an unexpected stressor, say, a bomb, blew a pyramid apart, the structure would not be able to reassemble itself. A coral reef, on the other hand, survives hurricanes not by being robust, but through resilience. Storms will destroy a certain proportion of coral, but if the reef is at a healthy size, it will regenerate in short order. One reason coral reefs are now failing is that the damage inflicted by humans, unlike periodic storms, is too fast and unrelenting to allow the critical mass of regrowth needed for resilience. Even a resilient system can be broken when too much comes at it too fast. Robustness is achieved by strengthening parts of the system, the pyramid. Resilience is the result of linking elements that allow them to reconfigure or adapt in response to change or damage, the coral reef. Our approach to many environments, from the factory floor to the battlefield, has concentrated on building and hardening robust structures to withstand specific anticipated dangers. But all those environments are, as we discussed in the previous chapter, increasingly susceptible to unforeseen and unforeseeable disruptions. To survive them, we need to become both robust and resilient. The insights of resilience thinking are applicable to many domains in which people are searching for a way forward in the face of uncertainty. The key lies in shifting our focus from predicting to reconfiguring. By embracing humility, recognizing the inevitability of surprises and unknowns, and concentrating on systems that can survive and indeed benefit from such surprises, we can triumph over volatility. As Zolli puts it, if we cannot control the volatile tides of change, we can learn to build better boats. Efficiency and adaptability. The focus of management for a century has been on efficiency, getting the most of a desired output. We call this variable Y, with the least of the available input, X. In Taylor's steel mill, Y was yards of steel cut, and X was hours of machine use. For our task force, at least initially, Y was operations, and X was men and materiel. The problem, as we discussed, is that you can only optimize for efficiency if you can identify X and Y sufficiently far in advance to build a dependable system for converting one into the other. The pursuit of efficiency is grounded in prediction. If you know that your company will be producing cars and only cars for the foreseeable future, then building an assembly line that is optimized for the axles and airbags and can convert a little human labor and steel into a lot of cars makes sense. But such a system becomes useless when you suddenly have no need for cars and instead need helicopters by week's end. All the efficiency in the world has no value if it remains static in a volatile environment. We had built an awesome machine, an efficient military assembly line. But it was too slow, too static, and too specialized, too efficient to deal with that volatility. It was the equivalent of the Delta Works or the Maginot Line, robust at doing specific, long-planned-for things, but incapable of swift, effective responses to the unexpected. We were robust, but not resilient. When we realized that AQI was outrunning us, we did what most large organizations do when they find themselves falling behind the competition. We worked harder. We deployed more resources. We put more people to work. And we strove to create ever greater efficiency within the existing operating model. Like obnoxious tourists trying to make themselves understood in a foreign country by continuing to speak their native tongue louder and louder, we were raising the volume to no good end. If AQI's presence in Baghdad had been static, and if their movements had been constrained by the speed of tanks or marching, we could have built a nifty master plan for removing their fighters while defending our sites and efficiently rotating personnel and equipment in and out of the fight. It would have been a math problem, albeit a complicated one rife with danger. As with the world wars, the more efficiency we could add to the solution, the faster the conflict would come to an end. Those certainties, however, did not exist. That long-range master plan is of little use when a Quran-burning scandal in one city sets off a global furor in internet chat rooms and, overnight, a ruthless cell in another place is activated and deploys tactics we have never seen before. Or when intelligence collected in Mosul indicates that a major attack on civilians will take place in Basra unless a SEAL team launches a raid that night, a raid for which there is no time to plan, let alone send data back and forth from Washington. Connecting all these dots on the fly would require a flexibility that our task force just did not have. Peter Drucker had a catchy statement. Efficiency is doing things right. Effectiveness is doing the right thing. If you have enough foresight to know with certainty what the right thing is in advance, then efficiency is an apt proxy for effectiveness. In the wayward swirl, however, the correlation between efficiency and effectiveness breaks down. The task force had built systems that were very good at doing things right, but too inflexible to do the right thing. Following Taylor's advice, we worked to get a lot of Y with a little X. Y being operations, and X being men and materiel. But an efficient conversion of X to Y wasn't what we needed. We needed to get the right things in the right place with speed and accuracy, so we could seize opportunities that might evaporate in just a few minutes. In effect, we needed a system that, without knowing in advance, what would be required, could adapt to the challenges at hand. A system that, instead of converting a known X to a known Y, would be able to create an unknown output from an unpredictable input. Just as flood protection systems can be robust but not resilient, and the former often comes at the cost of the latter, management